For KOSU, I'm Michael Cross, and it's time once again for This Week in Oklahoma Politics with ACLU Oklahoma Executive Director Ryan Kiesel and Republican political consultant Neva Hill. And then there was one. New York billionaire Donald Trump becomes the last man standing in the race for the GOP nomination for president. The reaction from Oklahoma Republicans has been somewhat mixed, from Governor Fallon supporting Trump and hoping he calls her as a running mate, to Oklahoma City Senator David Holt saying he won't vote for him. Neva, what are your thoughts?
Well, I think we do have this great divide and this great mix, and we have as many folks, really, when you think about it, in even Oklahoma in the primary, we had 72% of the folks that went to the polls in that Republican primary that had a pick other than Donald Trump. I mean, so I think with 10 weeks to go, looking toward Cleveland and the national convention, it is really going to be very interesting to watch and see if Trump can really begin to bring some of these groups together, bring some of the intensity down, and get folks to come on board. If not in some fashion of being supportive, at least not being openly against. And I think this hashtag Never Trump movement that was very, very evident in the closing stretch, there seems to be nothing about that that is going to go away. So here's a guy who spent $36 million of his own money. Now he talks about he's loaned the campaign money, so it's going to be fascinating to see if he wants to recover that money. And looking toward a fall campaign, which all of the estimates that I'm seeing say that it's going to be $1 billion spent on each side in this fall campaign. So I think that bottom line, Donald Trump has a very difficult, daunting task to try to rally Republicans and get them, to coalesce at this national convention. And it remains to be seen what some of these large contingencies of blocks of votes with Cruz and others do, because, I think that we have an unusual situation in that normally in an election you have a tough campaign, but people do kind of hold their nose and come back together. This remains to be seen with Donald Trump.
Ryan.
Yeah, Andrew Sullivan, the writer, the political writer, has said, as much as we like American democracy and we're taught to herald American democracy as this bastion of hope in the free world, it's not immortal, in his words, nor should we assume it's immune to the forces that have endangered democracy so many times in human history. He called Trump an extinction-level candidate, and I think that that's really what we're dealing with right now, is this idea that a Trump presidency could upend everything that we hold dear about the United States of America. We have been told time and again, all the way back in over a year ago now, that there was no way that Trump was going to get the nomination, certainly no way that he was going to get the White House. Nate Silver at 538, everybody who thinks is the guru of predicting how these things are going to happen, he's had him at 0% and 4% of getting the nomination. Here he is, he's the nominee. David Roberts in Vox was talking about right now, even on the Republican side, we're hearing all of this talk about how Trump is, there's no way that he is fit to be president, that we have never had a choice like this where you have probably Hillary Clinton, but either Hillary or Bernie, two people that I think we could all say would be fit to be president, running against somebody who is so vastly unqualified and dangerous to be president of the United States. But what David Roberts is pointing out is that in short order, we're going to get to a point where both the media and the partisan politics that we have in the United States are going to demand a competitive race. So the headline of, Trump is unfit to be president and will lose terrifically in November of this year, that's going to go to the wayside, and we're going to have it will quickly become a partisan statement to say that Donald Trump is unfit to be president. And so the idea that he is going to get just demolished by Hillary, or maybe in an unlikely chance Bernie Sanders in November, we shouldn't just count on that.
Well, on both of these folks, Clinton and Trump, when you look at their high negatives, you have a very unusual situation developing, assuming she is the nominee. If it's Sanders, again, a different scenario. But you have both parties with their nominee in a place where they have to do a better than average job of getting their folks to come around and be totally supportive of the nominee, at least in the broad picture. And I think that's going to be one of the high thresholds for both sides, is where is the crossover going to be and where are the stay-at-home numbers going to be? And that's the real question that everyone is looking at, is Are we going to have an election where a lot of people just say, okay, I don't like any of this, and just stay home?
Trump is now being able to focus right on Clinton. Should Bernie Sanders drop out of the race, Ryan, so that Clinton can then now focus directly on Trump?
You know, I don't think so. I think that, you know, there's definitely the sense that I think that we've seen this from the Sanders campaign, that he has begun to moderate his rhetoric against Clinton, and he's running a campaign much more about where he stands. I think that he has said that he wants every state to be able to vote so that he can win as many delegates as possible going into the convention, even if it doesn't mean that he's going to be the nominee, so that he can influence the platform and the message of the Democratic Party. I think that that's important. But now that we're going to have this test period now, this trial run of a Trump versus Clinton general election in the lead up to the Democratic National Convention. So we still have California, New Jersey to vote next month. Those are huge delegate states. If it begins to look like that Clinton cannot fare well against Trump, you know, that she cannot be a match, and we've already begun to see Trump attacking Clinton on NAFTA, which is something that can divide Democratic voters, mm-hmm. white Democratic voters, sure. in particular in the Midwest, that are union voters that would traditionally be with a Democratic candidate. He may be able to divide them away on stuff like that. And so if the Democratic Party and Democratic delegates, including superdelegates, begin to see that, then we may see this idea, it's too important to beat Trump, and we've got to have the best nominee there. So I think it's probably Hillary, and I think that she does enter with an advantage against Trump, but it's something that
and
everybody's going to have to look at.
On the Republican side, most people would be smiling if they thought that Bernie Sanders was going to be the nominee versus Hillary Clinton, to the extent that it's a very sharp, clear contrast, and you take away much of the debate on some of these issues in terms of policy and kind of the Washington inside approach that will be very much part of the entire discussion as we get into the fall campaign. And frankly, it'll be very interesting to see what both nominees do with respect to their vice presidential pick.
Yeah. Well, and speaking of that, Mary Fallon now has she's now welcoming the talk of Donald Trump being Donald Trump's running mate. Openly has endorsed him 100%. It reminds me of the George Will quote not too long ago. George Will, the Republican conservative commentator, who said that anyone that would be Donald Trump's running mate is inherently not fit to be his running mate because they trust him to be president of the United States. And so the idea that Mary Fallon trust Donald Trump to be president of the United States, I think, makes her unqualified to be his running mate.
And she waited till everyone else was gone, but she also supported Trump in a state where it went completely for Cruz when the primary happened.
That's correct. So very interesting.
Yeah. Lawmakers now have just 3 weeks till the end of the session with still no move on a budget. The Oklahoman released an article on Sunday saying budget bills are expected next week, but without any specifics. Ryan, what are your expectations here?
I think that we're this late in the budget process. There doesn't seem to be any sort of coalescing in either the Senate or the House over new revenue models that would help offset cuts. I suspect that we're going to see budget bills that include devastating cuts to healthcare, education, and corrections. And there's going to be really no long-term fix. I mentioned this last week, but it's this idea of keeping our head above water and hopefully getting us into the next legislative session with something that we can work with. But that's the model right now, right? Is that we keep doing that. We keep kicking the can down the road. And hopefully, you know, we just cross our fingers that we're going to have leadership that steps up to the table, gets us there. But that's just not happened. So I don't expect anything big. There's going to be no real solutions. And if it works at all, it's only going to work as a Band-Aid and a salve.
Neva.
I think that may be where we're at. I think we're coming down to the final weeks, and lawmakers want to be out on the last day of May and go home, go campaign, whatever they need to do. So I think they will cobble together a budget much akin to what they've done in previous sessions. And it will be very difficult, given the budget hole, not to have these across the board very significant cuts. And you have all of the agencies now coming out front, having groups that obviously are going to be seriously impacted by these cuts coming forward and trying to apply a little pressure on the lawmakers and say, we just can't sustain this, we can't have this. But this is not a new problem. It's just one. Ryan's right. I mean, we've kicked the can down the road. We have to look at basically taking both sides, House and Senate, cobbling together something that neither likes but both can live with, and sign and go home. So it's not a good way to deal with the budget. And I think it only points to the fact that it will heighten the need to have a very different tone and approach in the next legislative session as opposed to this one.
Republican lawmakers select new leaders as their current ones face term limits. The Senate taps Mike Schultz of Altus to replace Brian Bingaman, and the House selects Charles McCall from Atoka, taking the reins from House Speaker Jeff Hickman. Neva, what do you think about these choices?
Well, I think no big surprises. I think, frankly, on both sides, even though there was competition, it was fairly amicable, and I think we had kind of a coalescing behind the House and the Senate, the person that came out on top. And frankly, that speaks well for the majority as they learn to caucus and learn to begin to develop an ability to coalesce behind a leader and try to build some consensus as they look down the road.
Ryan.
You know, I visited with some Democratic lawmakers about the selection of Charles McCall as the next speaker, and I think that there's some optimism there. He's not seen as somebody who is a radical fringe part of the Republican caucus. But I do think that there is some concern about his lack of experience. I mean, here's a gentleman who, regardless of his resume and his demeanor.
Well, he just was elected in 2012.
He's been in the legislature for 4 years.
Right.
And the idea that, you know, it's hard to imagine a Fortune 500 company that was, you know, watching their ledger book in total free fall. I mean, they're on the verge of collapsing and on the verge of bankruptcy, looking around the country trying to find a chief operating officer and saying, let's bring in a guy that's got 4 years experience. This is a product of term limits. You know, he was elected largely by the freshmen, the newer members of the Republican caucus, and that was his constituency. I can remember, and I've been told stories about some older legislative leaders whenever they talk about, if you wanted to be Speaker of the House, how long did you need to be there? And it used to be, if you really worked it, maybe 8, but probably 12.
Or 15,
this is going to empower a lot of unelected people. You know, the bureaucracy in the legislature and lobbyists are going to have a lot more power.
But what I think you may see is a shift, because we don't have someone who is just going to be the potential of only a one-term speaker. And that changes the dynamic significantly, sure, because he very well may be more than a one-term speaker. And in doing that, I mean, here's someone, you have to look at his overall resume, not just his years in the legislature. A very successful banker, won a seat that had never been held by a Republican, clearly has been very proactive, not only in the past session, but almost from the day he got to the legislature, in being willing to go out and help other lawmakers, raise money, do things that are necessary. So he built up a lot of goodwill, built up a lot of chips, and I think also, given his background and the fact that he said his number one priority was going to be job growth in Oklahoma, and diversifying the state revenue, he is a guy that does understand numbers, does understand what we're facing, and frankly, I think given that resume and given his positioning, makes him an ideal speaker designate.
A state question to put wine in grocery stores and allow liquor stores to sell items like a convenience store gets killed by the state Supreme Court. Ryan, what was wrong with this bill?
You know, the Supreme Court, and I think rightly so, regardless of where you stand on this issue, you know, said that the gist of the measure that was going to be put in front of the voters did not accurately explain to the voters what exactly this question was going to do. And, you know, this just, if anything, this just adds to the confusion about the attempts to modernize Oklahoma's beer and liquor laws. Mm-hmm. You know, we have multiple things that are running right now. There's still a potential ballot question in front of the Secretary of State right now that you know, that could end up on the ballot. We've got a measure working its way through the legislature being championed by Senator Jolly and Senator Bice. And so I think that, you know, there's still some opportunity out there to reform these laws. But I mean, this has added a lot of confusion to it. And I think it's something that most Oklahomans want to see happen. I mean, we have, you know, very antiquated liquor laws in the state of Oklahoma, and it's not something new. It goes back to our history. We're the only state in the nation to enter the Union with prohibition in our state's constitution.
Right.
I mean, we've made prohibition in our alcohol laws a constitutional issue, which has largely made it not impossible, but very difficult for people to change these laws.
You can't just have a law that says, okay, we'll take that off the books.
Right.
Because we part of the alcohol laws that we follow are on statutory, and some of them are constitutional. So this is really confusing, and it's not getting any easier to
fix.
That's
right. And I think the concept of repealing Article 28 has a lot of support for that very reason, that we need to get to a place when we want to change things. It's not just changing them in the Constitution, but that we can do it statutorily. So it is kind of pulling the entire article out of the Constitution and starting over. And I think while some people are always reticent to that idea, mm-hmm. it's a time that I think we're seeing growing sentiment across the board, regardless of just personal preference or personal beliefs on the issue of wine, beer, alcohol, all of that. It's about legislatively, what do we do that makes this better in terms of just dealing with it from that standpoint?
And there'll be more talk about it.
Well, OETA did a segment on this several years ago, but I think it's still relevant. And I think you can watch it online for free. It's called Prohibition and Liquor 2, and it's the story of alcohol laws in the state of Oklahoma. It's this history. Folks need to, you know, take 30 minutes out of your time, go stream this, watch it, and get a sense of how we got to this point today where we're just like, what is going on? And the political interest at play and the different things where we assume that people want these laws, but really the people are far ahead of the legislature.
Well, there are people who are drinking age right now who don't remember that there was liquor by the drink that you couldn't go into places with and just order a gin and tonic.
Not that long ago.
Absolutely. Well, it's 86. So
yeah.
Well, and the Senate bill 383, I mean, it's 270 pages long. I mean, it takes a long time, even for lawmakers, if they're going to read this bill, they've got a lot of homework to take home and look at this weekend, because it is. I mean, it challenges them to do a lot of work, and now we're at the end of session in a very short period of time. It'll be interesting to see. It's been out there all session long, was pulled back from the session 2 years ago. So I think we are going to see probably something happen. I think it's just a question of what finally bubbles up and passes.
What we finally see at the end of the May. And Governor Fallon vetoes a bill requiring doctors to give parents written material about vaccinations at the time children receive the injections. The measure was supported by many right-wing conservatives. Neva, were you surprised by this veto?
Well, I think I was pleased that the governor went really along with a majority of folks in the medical community and even among lawmakers who looked at this and said that it is not about limiting the information discussion with the patients. It's not about trying to suppress that information, but it's about not forcing burdensome legislation on these physicians where they would have to literally go through pages upon pages with these vaccinations and make that information detailed to the patient and to the parents. So it makes no sense. I think it's one of these highly charged issues where you had parents that had become very emotionally connected to the issue, very passionate in lobbying at the legislature, felt like that it just, if that's what they wanted, that's what should happen. But I think cooler heads prevailed, and I think the governor looked at it very, very straightforward on the merits, and was very clear in her veto message why she did what she did.
Ryan,
there have been any number of times in her time in office as governor that Governor Fallon has ignored the cries from the medical community that certain legislative actions would have a very detrimental impact on the entire population or a segment of the population, in particular in areas of women's reproductive health. But here, I think that a lot of us were pleasantly surprised to see that she heeded it wasn't even just the advice. It was like it was very strong and adamant mm-hmm. caution that if we do this, you know, we're already behind in vaccination numbers according to the rest of the nation, you know, that we could go even further. And, you know, that has a real impact on the safety of our children, and in particular children that have weakened immune systems that can't be vaccinated, and then children that are too young to be vaccinated. And so if we don't have this group vaccination rate, if we don't hit these threshold numbers, you know, then outbreaks of things like mumps and measles, which can be very deadly, spring up. And in a state where rural hospitals are on the verge of closure, our healthcare system is in crisis as it is, the last thing that we need is to have this self-imposed disease and illness outbreak because we've decided to, you know, rubber stamp a piece of legislation that's based in politics and not
and
medicine.
And let's remember, we're talking about seven vaccines. We're talking about seven vaccines that cover 11 diseases, I believe it is. And very much, it bottom line, they looked at it, and it was about health and safety of the children that those vaccinations would be administered to, and they did the right thing.
Yeah, big thanks to Governor Fallon for doing that.
We didn't discuss this earlier, but I do want to talk about, although she vetoed that bill, she did sign a bill that one of my first bills to cover in the legislature when you were there was what was called Nick's Law. Mm-hmm. And it was forcing insurance companies to cover autism, and it was shot down. Basically, what was Nick's Law now has been passed. Were you surprised, Ryan, to finally see that become a law?
You know, this deal has been in the works for a very long time for any number of Oklahoma families that have struggled with autism and a diagnosis there. They've just been left out in the cold. I mean, they have just almost bankrupted themselves, and I would bet in some circumstances actually have, trying to just find the right care for their children. And so this idea that insurance companies need to step up, they're required to make this coverage available, this is a great day.
There was so much opposition to Nick's Law from Republicans, from House Speaker Chris Steele. Well, he wasn't House Speaker at the time, but and also Dan Sullivan. But then you needed a Republican who did feel very strongly about Jason Nelson, who came forward and said, no, we have to get this passed.
And I think that's one of those instances where you have a very complex bill with a lot of competing interests coming to the table initially with their strong point of view, and it does take time to work through those. I mean, they all had legitimate issues at the outset, and what we see now as the result, that took a long time. And I think just like in Ryan's time in the legislature, it takes a long time. You don't advance some new challenging idea or something that is in the estimation of some people very needed very quickly and move it through the process fast. It takes time and it takes effort on the part of a lot of folks.
Finally, staying on health, 300 Oklahomans rallied at the state capitol to keep cuts from coming to Medicaid. Many say budget reductions could hurt rural patients and hospitals, as well as closing many nursing homes. Ryan, how concerned should Oklahomans be about these cuts?
They should be incredibly concerned. And you mentioned nursing homes. The number of nursing home patients that would be forced out of nursing homes as a result of the provider rate cuts that are on the table and are likely to happen, barring some miracle in the legislature in the last few weeks, are just astounding. I mean, the numbers just really blow you away. Also, on top of that, these provider rate cuts are going to take away home health care services for a lot of people that keep them out of nursing homes. So we're going to increase the demand for nursing homes and at the same time undercut the number of nursing home beds available for the people of Oklahoma. And that's just one example of where we're currently at right now. The Medicaid expansion fight right now is really a political fight. I don't think that behind closed doors, really anyone is debating the merits of whether or not the state or states like Oklahoma can continue to afford to not expand Medicaid. It's really a debate over semantics and how governors and Republican-controlled legislatures can expand Medicaid without seeming to backtrack on their initial opposition to Obamacare and the Affordable Care Act and expansion of Medicaid at the outset. So they're trying to figure out how to do that because they desperately know that they need to, but they're being very careful about the politics. So,
Neva.
Well, and I think in that need to kind of shift some of the discussion because of where we are in this budget year, that we see that with Nico Gomez and the Medicaid rebalancing act, as it's being called, I think it is where we're seeing this shift in thinking of trying to figure out a way that legitimately we can look at what do we do to deal with the short term, just plug the holes, and then look at the longer term view of how we do we or do we not change philosophically what we're going to do with respect to federal funding, with respect to how we're going to advance the need to deal with this budget hole that's not going to go away. And it's not new. I mean, they've had these issues and crisis. This is not just this budget year. This has been an ongoing, many years problem. And now we're at a place where legitimately we are not only going to see continued cuts, but the question is, what does the legislature and what does the public want in terms of either more revenue, as you talk about all the time, Ryan? I mean, are we at a place where the majority of Oklahomans will say, yes, we'll pay more taxes if it goes to this? That's going to be one of the big questions, I think, that we're going to see next session.
Ryan and Eva's comments do not necessarily reflect the views of the ACLU, KOSU, its staff, or management.